ください。Right. I have to say, when I got Tom's outline, I had a moment of thinking that I should scrap what I was going to do and start again with it, as I don't think I could have done as thorough a review of the evidence, particularly on the Scottish side, as he has done. Partially that's because we operate without some of the stabilising factors that operate in Anglo-Saxon England, in particular the stabilising of Bede and the stabilising of such a rich, as is the case with Northern England, such a rich archaeological legacy in terms of the burials before the 7th century. What this presentation is going to do, I'm not going to attempt a thorough review of the written and material evidence for conversion or pagan Christian encounter in the early medieval period in Scotland and to a lesser extent Ireland. Instead, I'm going to focus in on a series of texts that will be used, and there's a handout for this as well, with translations at any rate of the texts that I'll be talking about as we go on. A series of texts that will be used to suggest the seams that we need to explore in order to get firmer appreciation of the situation. And also, I think, to question, in a way I see this partially as the function of this session, to question how firm a grip we can get on the situation with the sources available to us. And I think that's been a sort of undercurrent percolating right the way through the day, and I'm sure it will go on tomorrow. When I wrote in the summary for my colleagues, for Roy and for Tom, the word seems, S-E-A-M-S, it struck me that the ambiguity of that word was entirely appropriate. Clearly struck Roy as well, because he commented on an email. On the one hand, a seam is a deposit of mineral wealth, coal, iron ore, or the like. The material at our disposal, and I'll mostly be talking about the textual evidence, because that's I'm not an archaeologist. The material at our disposal needs to be mined like a seam. The riches therein are not lying on the surface usually, and surface readings, as Tom described in the case of Bede, are often facile and misleading. But a seam is also, as you know, the join between two pieces of fabric, the join between the pre-Christian world, pagan if you want, and the Christian one was not seamless. And exploring the places where the seams are visible, trying to pull them apart, that's what gives us our best hope of understanding what we might mean by conversion. Before I go on to discuss the texts in question, the text I want to concentrate on, a word by way of positioning myself. And when I wrote this, I thought that this was something that these are two little bugbears that I thought were mostly mine, but it's become clear that this is something that is shared among other speakers as well. There are two aspects of conversion that seem to me to be underplayed in thinking about conversion, and maybe I'm just talking about the past and not the present. I think that's clearly the case. One is the role of the individual, and with the individual, his or her kin, and the role of conviction. Of course, the big men have always had their day in the narratives of conversion: Columba, Patrick, Aidan, whoever, medieval or modern. And these aren't the individuals I mean, though they're part of the story. I'm thinking, and we'll see examples of this in a minute, about the many anonymous men and women whose obscure decisions, or at any rate actions and words, resulted cumulatively in the conversion of the Isles. Like Tom, I'm engaged in a book, or rather re-engaged, having dropped all work on it around 2003 when I became head of department in Glasgow, and I'm re-engaging. This is part of the process of re-engagement. Part of the sketchiness of this is a result of that. It's a half-written book, and hence half-unwritten. that's the trouble. But one thing that is written is the quote on the frontispiece. That's a bit sort of bit of hubris or incentive or something. It's from the very end of George Eliot's Middlemarch. For the growing good of the world is partly dependent on unhistoric acts, and that things are not so ill with you and me as they might have been is half owing to the number who lived faithfully a hidden life and rest in unvisited tombs. It's far from clear to me how any model or paradigm can adequately account for that or for individual choices. And I think we ignore, and other people have been saying this, we ignore the existence of people we know nothing about. Thinking of Donald Rumsfeld as both known and unknown unknowns, we ignore these things at our peril. My other worry is about the role of religious conviction. It seems to me recent years have seen a predominantly, I don't know what the term is here, post-Christian, post-convicted, post-something, approach to understanding the conversion of these islands to Christianity. There's no problem with this. Focus has been on, for instance, a kind of power paradigm of conversion focusing on the elite, and I think Tom has rightly called our attention to this in his previous talk, warriors, churchmen, the fusion between the two. And I think this is right, since so much of our evidence emerges from these categories of society. Focus has also come to be on seeing religious choice as a strategy of identity formation. All this is certainly an improvement on the simple missionary paradigm of earlier years, and the pietistic and apologetic approach to religious history obviously just won't work. My worry here is that we often do the people of the past the disservice of not allowing them to believe what they appear to have said they believed. We assign them motives they may well not have assented to: strategy, identity, power, and that we fail to allow for the notion that genuine religious conviction lay behind individual conversions, both from paganism to Christianity, or indeed, in the case of some apostasies, from Christianity to paganism, and I think this is something I want to talk a wee bit about, from shallower to deeper forms of religious faith. I think it's worth keeping these issues in mind as we explore the text I'm going to look at. Since it's the feast of St. Avernon, happy feast, I felt, and this has kind of guided my choice of where to go with all the different things I could have talked about, I felt it wise to start with some texts from his hand. My choice of structure has been determined by my desire to talk about Avernon on his feast day. Why not? As you'll know, Avernon, 9th abbot of Iona, who died on this day in 704, wrote his Vita Sancti Columbae sometime during the 690s. I've suggested, and so have others, the life shows signs of having composed over a longish period of time. Avernon is in many ways a poor witness to both conversion and to the pagan-Christian encounter. He wrote, like Bede, from within a context and at a time in which he may have rarely encountered someone who is not a Christian, at least in name. I think it's not so certain maybe in the case of Avernon, but I get that feeling from him. The religious disputes of his time were mostly about orthodoxy and orthopraxy, not about the pagan-Christian divide. His Columba, the person he's writing about, on the other hand, did experience that divide firsthand. And so Avernon's narratives have been crucial in how the conversion of Scotland is understood and described and written about, both in previous times and in the present. But what is his understanding of conversion and of the nature of the pagan and the Christian? We'll look at a number of narratives, and we could look at them in more depth than I'm going to, so we can maybe kick them around for the next couple of days, including ones discussing wells. We've talked about watery places. Well, here's a narrative for you. The conversions of families and individuals, and also the notion of good pagans. And I rather stupidly forgot to bring bring my handout up with me, so I'm going to... thank you very much. Mine is down there somewhere. thank you. His narratives, however much they're compromised by the positions, both geographical and theological, from which he writes, are still instructive, particularly for the way in which he views these at an individual and a local level, far removed, I think, from Bede's grander narratives of royal conversion. Equally, though, the problems of his witness must alert us to the deeply problematic position from which our more narrative texts relating to the conversion centuries were written, be it even more than Avernon, if you followed all that. I'm going to take each of these encounters and incidents in turn. So the first is Vita Columbae, Book 2, Chapter 11, which recounts an incident which in a way is a stock in trade of of hagiography, but has a particular resonance in a northern British context, in which Columba changes the valency of a well, which is being worshipped as a god by the locals. They're worshipped in a rather odd way because it seems to curse people and cause deformity if they wash themselves in it. One was how good a grasp Elvenon has of I think he knows exactly what he's doing, but anyway. Columba comes along, and despite mockery from the local magicians, wizards, druids, whatever you want to translate them as, despite their mockery, he washes his hands and blesses the well. Actually, he does it the other way around, drinks from the water, and from that day on, the demons are gone, and the well becomes a Christian holy well, efficacious in healing people. Vita Columbae 2:11 makes a companion piece to the chapter before it, which I haven't given you, in which Columba strikes a spring from a rock in order to baptize a child, prophesying a long and mixed life for the child. The place where his parents were was in Ardnamurchan, and a little spring is still to be seen there, which is powerful in the name of St. Columba, Adonon tells us in Book 2, Chapter 10. There's nothing to suggest in Adonon's work that he saw the venerating of wells and springs as blessed and efficacious, and we might guess from another incident, this was true of trees, as being something intrinsically pagan. Rather, such things depended on the valency of the power within them, whether they were of God or of the devil. This isn't simply the injunction of Gregory the Great to Augustine to convert the shrines of the pagans. With Adonon, I think we enter a slightly roomier house, and I'd be interested in people disagreeing with me about this. The converted here still may need signs and wonders, miraculous cures or animal traps that miraculously get animals for you. Columba the Thaumaturge is the great outward sign of Iona, an island itself, powerful in the name of St. Columba. Adonon's openness to the miraculous, and some might say superstitious, has continued to be a cause of consternation to his modern readers. And yet, in some ways, he probably brings us closer to the level at which Christianity made sense to a lot of people in the 6th and 7th centuries. The narrative about the well, though, is intriguing also because it introduces two features ostensibly from the pagan world that must be tested and contested. One is the worship of watery places, and we've heard a lot about this already, and especially springs. There's abundant evidence to show that this was indeed a feature of pre-Christian religion and ritual in Britain and Ireland. There's northern British evidence to bring as a counterpart to some of what is there in England and certainly in Ireland. In that sense, Adonon is here treating something of great import, the turning of a pre-Christian divine spring into a Christian one. Many such springs and wells from the early medieval period and beyond are still with us, and still bear the names of saints. My one reference to the... my one excuse for being here on Leverhulme-funded project money, sorry. The apparent ease with which the valency of the well is changed by Columba. I mean, he essentially, you know, turns the tap and it all goes the other way. This is impressive and instructive. Though I have to say, Adonon's sense of the nature of pagan holiness as being based on malignancy is both staged and overly symmetric. Not just simplistic, but it's symmetric. He's trying to do something with the rhetoric here that makes us not just uncertain, but doubtful that he really has any good appreciation of what people were doing with such wells, or they know exactly what they were doing with such wells, and he wants to mask it in this sort of cloak of bad mood music in the background. I think this is kind of inevitable in terms of his worldview. And more problematic in this encounter, in this story, are the magi, I'll just leave them in Latin, who feature in a number of Adonon's encounter stories, often in this role of mocking onlookers, rather than particularly as religious practitioners. I've been kind of pondering as the things have been going on, to what extent Adonon thinks of these people as ritualists. It's certainly not how he displays them. These are powerful guys, they're, I suppose, wise men in their community who can be relied on to say, oh, your God is rubbish. But what is their function beyond that? That's not quite clear. They seem pure. This is a great contrast to Muruchu's, competitors with Patrick and his wonderful narratives of conversion in the life of Patrick. Athernon's magi seem poorly defined, with the possible exception of the chief magus Broichan. The Andersons used magician to translate this term, and Athernon and Richard Sharp used wizard, thus avoiding the term druid. And I think this is right. I mean, it's partly on the basis of not importing a class of professional, probably religious figures, ahistorically, from Ireland to Scotland. But we should wonder whether that might not have been just what Athernon was doing himself, that he was actually importing his idea of what these people were like, not from his own experience of Pictland, but from his knowledge of Irish tradition or an Irish background. In any case, both translations seem rightly, to my mind, to be seeing them as Athernon wanted us to see them. You know, they're, you know, magicians, wizards, has a slightly denigrating feel to it. Though only one episode, I think, has that element of magical competition that's to the fore in Muruchu. Largely, they're local wise men who prove to be unwise. The question for us is whether we invest these accounts with any credibility. Were there religious professionals in pre-Christian Pictland? Perhaps, but it's to be doubted that Athernon's anecdotes have much to do with them. And if we're not to find such individuals in Athernon, for Scotland during this period, we won't find them anywhere. If there were pre-Christian religious professionals in northern Scotland, they're lost to us. And I don't see how we can recover them. Sorry to say that. But I'd be happy to hear some alternative. I'd be lovely if you come up with solutions. Moving on to two other, I think, paired narratives, Vita Columbae, Book 2, Chapter 32, and Book 3, Chapter 14, are interesting in very different ways. Here, Athernon shows us conversion at the level of the individual and the family. We have to acknowledge that he also saw signs and wonders, as well as preaching, as the fulcrum on which conversion and conviction would rest. And this, of course, is problematic. Nonetheless, I think it's an interesting contrast from Bede's kingly conversions and mass baptisms. These small-scale gains, which happen against a backdrop of naysaying, but essentially powerless, magi, introduce both the themes of the individual and of conviction I mentioned earlier. Just due to time, I'm just going to leave those two very eloquent encounters, maybe just to sort of speak for themselves. I mean, both relate to events that allow for the conversion either of individuals, but particularly of families of individuals somewhere out there in Pictland. In one case, we know the place. In 314, we're told specifically. 314, which according to James Fraser's analysis would perhaps come from Kamena's earlier work, we know this to be in Urchad, on the shores of Loch Ness. Vita Columbae, Book 1, Chapter 33, is another matter. This text, much discussed recently by Tomás O'Sullivan, who has shown the way in which, whilst not quite Augustinian, the account is nonetheless anti-Pelagian. Its interest for us is partly to do with Athernon's vision of the pagan here. In this, as also in Book 3, Chapter 14, we see the good pagan, the pagan who has previously had, as far as we can see, no encounter with Christianity and meets someone who can baptize him only at the end of his life. It's an impressive lesson, despite this, you know, this is quite staged encounters. It's still an impressive lesson that Athernon is open to the notion that angels would hasten to meet the soul of a worthy pagan. And Columba, of course, can see these angels hastening to meet them. For Athernon, then, the true separation was not so much between the Christian and the pagan as between the virtuous and the wicked. This fault line runs through tale after tale, and nothing automatically places any individual on one side or another of the divide. Virtuous kings jostle with evil ones, holy monks with ones guilty of a host of sins. Side by side with the distinction of goodness lies the ability to repent. Another theme of Avignon is the sinner who voices his repentance but fails to act on it. In this world, God's grace is offered, yet falls on the sort of ground which God himself has prepared. Columba sees God's will before it takes effect. He's given the ability to sense on which side of the divide of good and evil a person's soul will fall. There's perhaps a level at which this reflects Avignon's own experience of a world of Christians whose professed faith, indeed whose adoption of the religious or the secular life, is no determinant of goodness or lack of virtue. Once you get past the conversion period, it becomes obvious that there are sort of good people and bad people, no matter what, whether they're baptized or not. It's the same pastoral world inhabited in a different way by the penitentials that Tom was talking about and others have. One tale in particular, which I haven't given you, brings this home, perhaps this pastoral reflection on the Christian community. It's set in Columba's day, but I think it could almost as easily reflect Avignon's experience in the 7th century. This is book 1, chapter 50, for those of you who have... Have the life of Columba sort of, hardwired into your brain. It's not there, but I'll read it. At the same time, Conall, Bishop of Coleraine, collected almost innumerable offerings from the people of Magnaelne and prepared a lodging for St. Columba on his way home from the meeting of the kings with a great crowd of people around him. When the saint arrived, the many offerings of the people were set out in the open area of the monastery for him to bless them. Looking at them as he blessed them, he pointed in particular at the gift of a rich man. The man, he said, who gave this enjoys the mercy of God on account of his generosity and his mercies to the poor. Picking out another item from among the many offerings, he said, "Of this offering, the gift of a man both wise and greedy, I cannot so much as taste unless he first does penance for his sin of avarice." Columba's discernment leads to the inner conversion of these two men, with the result that, quote, both of them were corrected and healed of their particular faults. And just a final pairing of tales from Avignon in what's kind of descended into just a sort of conveyor belt here, confronts us with a further reflection on the mixed nature of God, his saint, and the sinner. Actually, I think I'm just going to talk about one of these tales. In this one that I've got in mind, a band of brigands who are wicked and bloodstained are nonetheless protected. This is in book 1, chapter 1. Are nonetheless protected from death by the singing of Gaelic songs in praise of Saint Columba. Here, the invocation of the saint's name is seen as protection in itself. And again, we've had people mentioning this idea earlier today. We're perhaps two steps away from the personal struggle of conversion here. This is the almost accidental salvation through the proxy of invoking the honourable man of God. We're not even shown in this vignette the sequel of the saving of these brigands. Do they leave behind their wicked and bloodstained lives for a better future? We're not actually told. Now, two of those poems the brigands recite could be those, no reason to suppose they were, by Bekon or perhaps Begon Mac Lugdiach. These come from the mid-7th century. And sorry, I've given these for some reason on page slightly out of order. Page 3, come from the mid 7th century, and the equation of this person with either of the two Hebridean Bekons on offer is far from certain, but still quite possible. These are extraordinary poems. His poems, both in literary terms and in terms of the images they trade in. I'm interested here, though, just in one sequence in one of these poems. The vision of Columba's heroism is one which involves him embracing odd things that mark him out from the secular norm in Ireland. Books, boats, learning, things that normal aristocrats didn't trifle with. This exemplifies a different seam in the nature of conversion, that between the lay and the spiritual life, whether one's Christian or not. And I think Tom illustrated that very eloquently with that illustration from Wearmouth. To what extent does becoming Christian entail departure from secular norms in the world of power? And how do we distinguish between different levels of conversion in the rhetoric of our texts? I mean, one thing to note about Bacon's text is that it uses imagery and techniques which ally it to secular praise poetry. Columba's hero, Columba as hero in Bacon's poetry exists on the seams at least between secular and Christian as between pagan and Christian, and his control of such imagery speaks to someone steeped in the practices of native poetry. And finally, a possibly 8th century text describes a mysterious encounter between Columba and a strange youth, Moira mentioned this text this morning, who reveals mysteries to the saint. This perspective encounter is a reminder that at least within Gaelic culture, a series of texts reveals an openness to the past and to possibilities that go well beyond the biblical. In this, those of you who aren't familiar with it, in this, Columba meets this youth. Some say he was Mongon MacFiachna. I don't even want to go there when talking about this. That's just an added sort of glossing headache. Columba has this exchange with the youth what is this guy? Particularly in theological terms, what is he? And I think, as Moira said, John Carey's explored the sort of open-endedness of this sort of encounter extremely well. The youth comes from lands of strange things, from lands of familiar things. He talks about what the loch was before that is in front of them. He says, I know that. It was yellow, it was flowery, it was green, it was hilly. I've grazed it when I was a stag. I've swum it when I was a salmon, when I was a seal. I've run upon it when I was a wolf. I mean, it's brilliant stuff, isn't it? They continue this exchange, and one of the most marvelous things about it is the ending, which, after he's heard enough about this kind of thing, Columba says, right, that's enough. Looks over at his followers, who've been excluded from a large part of this conversation, and goes over to them. Suddenly the youth seems to disappear and they don't know where he's gone, and when Columba's followers ask him about that, Columba says, you know, guys, it's better if you just don't know anything about it. and that's the end. The wonderful openness and ambiguity, theological ambiguity of this is extremely salutary, I think. These are texts of the fully Christian period in Ireland, the 8th century. These encounters between saints and representatives of the pagan past or alternative worlds, which continue on right the way into the 13th century, reveal a continuing dialogue that's, I think, reasonably distinct between European culture. There's much more we could discuss about that here. Just to sort of land the plane, all these texts, and return to where we started really, all these texts are a far cry from the witness of Patrick, who's been mentioned already, but I want to mention him in a slightly different guise here. I give at the end two quotes from Patrick's Confessio. We've got nothing from the later period, anywhere in Britain or Ireland, like Patrick's work for getting to the heart of genuine conversion. And here I mean an individual's own conversion, from semi-believer to fully convinced religious practitioner, as also Patrick's conversion of individuals. So he gives us both. We've got both the interior and external conflict that could beset the converted in his pages. I've given only one short passage reflective of Patrick's description of his own interior journey here from the Confession chapter 21. But Patrick's account of his own turning to God is a hard-won achievement, attempting to express the inexpressible, and doing so in language which is all the more clear for its confusion and uncertainty. He's hesitant and confident in equal measure, and whilst he reads his past as having been guided by God, he gives us little sense of having always been certain of it at the time. Where he speaks in the present from a position in which his rather risky decision to travel into a non-Christian zone on the fringes of empire, with, one guesses, only the flimsy of authority as bishops, has been rewarded with converts, he's still able to discern how fraught with danger his life has been and how uncertain. He affords us a unique insight into one man's journey, one man's narrative of his journey, from conversion to conviction. Perhaps the most compelling passage on the conversion of others is his description of the women, including noble women, who had followed his preaching, which Adele has already called our attention to. So you got two translations for the price of one today. And that's on the final page of the handout. There are a number of leads. I'm coming to the end here. There are a number of leads we should pursue in this passage. It's undoubtedly important, especially when we look at the progress of Christianity in Anglo-Saxon England, that he puts so much emphasis on the conversion of women, indeed noble women. But we should not overlook the countercultural aspects of some of these conversions. His picture of the teenage daughters of the Irish middling classes turning to his cult is a vivid one. And the fact that the opposition of the parents to these conversions seems only to increase the trend is appealingly familiar. Far from the religion of the establishment for 5th century Irish teenagers, converting to Christianity was a surefire way to annoy your parents. It causes a laugh, but I think it's a serious point. More to the point, for women it was a potent, if dangerous, form of rebellion. These women, like Patrick's Blessed Lady, were many of them not only turning their backs on old religions, but also embracing virginity. Within the context of Irish cultural norms, this was perhaps the closest women could come to asserting their sexual independence. Not the only way, but a particularly strong way. Within the normal constraints of Irish law, women were on the whole under the control of a man, whether father, husband, or other kinsman, for the whole of their lives. Thus, the radical choice of conversion and virginity allowed these women to reappropriate their bodies away from the paternalistic norm. It's no exaggeration to see their embrace of Christianity in this as a form of sexual revolution. It's certainly social revolution of sorts. Sons and daughters of underkings are seen to be monks and versions of Christ. We get a strong impression then from Patrick of his constituency not being the nobility or the kings that we see elsewhere in conversion narratives, but the youth of Ireland, embracing his message in a sort of groundswell that seems frequently to take him by surprise as well. It's no wonder he's occasionally subject to attacks on his life, and he has to pay for bodyguards and safe passage. The opting out of the normal tramlines of Irish marital relationships and the property exchanges that went with them must have, on occasion, seemed to threaten the stability of Irish society itself. And that's where I think I'll stop. Thanks very much.